Welcome to Masters of the Stage and SDC Foundation podcast. I'm Ethan McSweeney, a proud trustee of the SDC Foundation and your host today for the first of what we hope will be a series of podcasts focusing on Masters of the Stage who have also carved out careers in the classical theater in America and sometimes beyond. I'm here today with Sharon Ott, Artistic Director of the Berklee Repertory Theater for 13 years, Artistic Director of Seattle Repertory Theater for 8 years, recent Artistic Director of the Performing Arts Department at Savannah College of Art and Design, and current Chair of the Virginia Commonwealth University Theater Department in Richmond, and herself a member of the SDC Board of Trustees, representing the Southeast region. We're here in the Southeast region, as a matter of fact, at the offices of the American Shakespeare Center in Stanton, Virginia, where I am currently the artistic director, and where tomorrow Sharon will open her production of Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra, which will play in repertory with a production of Julius Caesar that I've directed, both performed by the same company of 16 actors on the stage at ASC's iconic Blackfriars Playhouse, the world's only recreation of Shakespeare's indoor theater. We will, I hope, talk a little more about that production and your experience of working under the umbrella of Shakespearean performance conditions. But first, I thought maybe take me back, way back, to the moment that set you on your path to becoming a stage director.
Wow.
I know.
That's thinking way back. There's a particular moment in time.
Yeah.
It was in Hamburg, Germany. And I was in, so this must have been, I would say, early 70s. So I was in a company that was partially based in La Mama and partially based at the Mickery Theater in Amsterdam. And I was an actor.
You were an actor,
I was an actor in that company. And the director, a guy named Frans Marijnen, who's a Flemish, he's still alive, a Flemish director, sort of the precursor to Ivo van Hove. So ran the same thing. I believe ran after I was with him, ran the Toniel
group.
Yeah. Anyway, he and André Serban were sort of the same era, and Ellen Stewart sponsored both of them. So I'm an actor in that company, and the way we put things together was very, you know, very early 70s ensemble based, and I loved the process. And this piece, Les Chants du Mal d'Aurore, based on the French surrealist poem, was pretty successful on the European circuit, so we toured it a bunch. And as a young performer, it was probably the first time I'd really had to act in something over a long period of time.
Right.
And like many people, realized, wow, I'm really bored. And I don't know if I like performing all this much.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was a very distinctive moment in Hamburg where, I forget what part of the piece, but I was essentially restaging it in my head and was completely out of the moment. And, you know, my fellow actors were looking at me like, where's the line?
Nice.
Where are you? And it was very, very clear in my head that, oh, huh, I'm not going to be a performer and I need to become something different.
I mean,
so it was then.
That's an amazing story, because I've always thought that for many directors and choreographers too, there's the mind of the performer is so incredibly focused on the track that they are in, and it's such a beautiful thing to observe. And then the mind of the director or the choreographer is always busy a little bit outside of their sphere. And and while most of us get into it through performance, because that's a sort of early participation, that there is that time when you discover, like, I'm not going to be very satisfied focusing this astutely on one thing when what I am is more of a generalist.
Absolutely. It's one of the reasons why, you know, here and when I've worked at Utah Shakespeare, I always try to bring students, or because performing in companies like these where you do have a long, you know, performance schedule, it's really a tester for young performers, because if they like it, then they're probably going to stay actors. But it's a realization. And I remember at Utah, I've had four students from SCAD at various times in the company there. Three of them hung in there. One of them completely bolted and, you know, is the CEO of a startup in Atlanta.
Right.
And the other one is hanging with it, but I'm sure he's going to bolt and be a director pretty soon. The other two, you know, one's in Ashland playing all the leads. And, you know, so, but it was during that experience where I was their professor, so they talked to me. And the one who completely bolted, it was clear to her. right. after she finished that summer that that it was just not gonna, she had to think about something else, right. that acting wasn't gonna be it.
Right. I've always felt though, and now you've taught at a bunch of different training programs and led a few, that there's nothing wrong with learning and preparing through theater to do something else.
Absolutely. It's the best.
Yeah.
You know, and I loved my experience as an actor, and I loved the fact that I tried that, and I think it feeds into what I do, but I haven't gone back since.
Not since. So somewhere,
well, there was one time
somewhere in Europe, you gave up acting and you never really went back.
Well,
to
I did go back once because the American company that I joined afterwards, Theater X, they pulled me into it once.
Join Theater X as a director, though?
No, as an actor.
As an actor.
Yeah.
Okay.
But pretty quickly, my colleagues there realized that I would be of more use to them as a director. But they did pull me back in for one silly stint as a drunken blues singer.
to have had the internet back in the 70s, Sharon.
Exactly.
I mean, how fortunate you are that there must
that
be
there
somewhere.
Was not.
Somewhere there must be a clip of that, I hope. We're going to look for it. Did you go to school for directing? Or?
No.
No.
No, the tail end of the story about being in Europe and realizing I did start to look at catalogs of schools. And I also have a distinct, I mean, this is going to, my colleagues at Yale will probably not like this, but I looked at Yale School of Drama, and at the time the wording was, we discourage peripatetic freelance careerism. And not only did I have to look up peripatetic at the time, but I went, wait a minute, every single director I know was a peripatetic freelance careerist, including all the directors I knew from Yale.
Yes.
So I did not ever go to school to pursue directing.
I wonder how Yale was going to discourage freelance directing. I mean, you've just described the life of the freelance artist.
Absolutely.
So,
I don't know
so
if
what they wanted was somebody more institutional.
I guess. I don't know if that's still. I haven't looked at the current bulletin, whether it still has the same verbiage. But
I'm sure that it has evolved.
I think so.
Over time. What led, and I don't, this is not a leading question because I genuinely don't know the answer to this. How did you get from acting, discovering directing, ensemble theater making like Theater X to Berklee Repertory Theater and being an artistic director?
Through a path that I think is sadly unavailable to young people now. You know, again, if you sort of go back to the 70s and early 80s, it was a lot cheaper to live in urban areas. So
especially Berklee.
Yeah, I wasn't in Berklee. I actually came back to the U.S. and thought, because we had been in New York, the company, I was very familiar with New York.
Right.
But I also had a brief stint at CalArts as an actor.
Right.
I had been accepted into Herb Blau's program. So I sort of knew the L.A. area. And my sister was out there at Pomona College. So I actually picked L.A. I'm not sure why, but I went out there and basically got a job. And I was lucky enough to get a job at the time when affirmative action for women was really happening
mm-hmm.
in the film business. Because CalArts, I went to school with David Irving, who the actress Amy Irving's brother, longtime professor at NYU, I believe he's still there. And David Irving's uncle, Richard Irving, ran Universal at the time. And Universal had to hire women. And so I got a job selling 16mm films with Universal and actually was able to save up enough money to start my own theater company.
Okay, so you were a theater company starter.
Yeah, I started my own company, and you know, my father had been so happy because Universal had promoted me, and he thought my life was set. And
he was sure you were going to be a theater, a film director.
A film producer.
Film producer, yeah,
or
that would be
somebody in the money end
right,
of it.
Right, the money end of things, yeah.
But instead, I started this little theater company, and, you know, we were all refugees from either the company in Europe or CalArts. And was able to, you know, live in L.A. cheaply. I talked my Tai Chi instructor into letting us use the studio for rehearsals. Ron Sassi gave us our performance space at the Odyssey.
Yeah.
We did a weird Polish play that I don't understand now. I think my brain cells, I'd seen it in Europe, and Witold Gombrowicz's play, The Marriage.
Wow.
And I think it was the American premiere. I, at the time, wasn't... Anyway, long story short, nobody came to review it, and I didn't know what else was going to happen. And this is a true story. It seems strange, but on Venice Beach, where I lived, I met the photographer Robert Frank. And I did not know it was Robert Frank for the longest time. And he actually got a critic to come review it. It was reviewed well. And Robert Corrigan, who had left CalArts to go to Oberlin, saw it and hired me and my little band of five actors to come and be... I mean, you know, this is crazy that we were teaching acting in Milwaukee. But we went to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and we were in residence at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And kind of kept our company together and did some teaching of basic acting and Grotowski training. That's what we had all been trained as. And then through that, I met Theater X and was with them for about 7 years then. And then John Dillon and Sarah O'Connor were running Milwaukee Rep. And Sarah and John invited me in to become a resident director at Milwaukee. And then that kind of began my... career.
So that got you into the resident, the resident theater.
And John was the first person, God bless him, to go out to Berkeley Rep and direct American Buffalo. And it came, it was a co-production with Milwaukee. And I saw the wonderful actor Tony Amendola, who... You know, and I said, and Larry Shue was in that.
Oh my gosh, wow.
Yeah, and I said, are all the actors in Berkeley as good as Tony? And John said, it's a wonderful company. And they're looking for an artistic director. You want to apply. So I did.
And that's how that happened.
That's how that happened. So it would not have happened without John. I'm deeply indebted, John and Sarah both, for the, you know, and my colleagues at Theater X, who I worked with for a long, long time, putting together the piece, A Fierce Longing, that we did, won an Obie Award. And that, so all that helped. But, you know, I don't think the thing that I don't think is possible anymore, I really know that people can't go to Europe now easily as members of companies and be supported by the Dutch government. You know, that that was the best grad school experience, because it was the Mickrey Theater in Holland, and every week there was another company from, you know,
just seeing
Peter Stein and you know, Joint Stock, when Carol Churchill was the staff writer.
Right.
You know, it was every week another fabulous company, and seeing all that work and being exposed to all that, you know, it was better than any grad school I could have ever gone to. And then being able to go to, you know, see with Theater X, go back to the Mickrey and go to when Phil Arnault ran the theater festival in Baltimore. And then ultimately to be in a resident company like Milwaukee Rep, where I could get a little bit more feeling of what it was like to be in a in that kind of lort company.
There is a discipline to working inside the company framework, whether that company is articulated as clearly as the Milwaukee Rep or loosely affiliated as you would have at a Berkeley Rep. Because you didn't really have a like a defined company at Berkeley Rep, did you?
We did when I first
came. Okay.
Yeah, and that was part of, you know, I admit that was part of the growing pains of the company, because when I came there, I was, it was very clear. I had done all this work with Japanese theater.
Yes.
With Milwaukee Rep.
Yes.
And prior to me even arriving at Berkeley, the playwright Philip Kongotanda wrote me, because he had heard about and sent me a play of his, and he was a Bay Area resident. And I came in kind of knowing that one of the things I wanted to do was focus on the emerging Asian American audience and artists in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I knew I had a company of, I'm not sure if it was 9 or 10, but 9 or 10 really very, very good, but all Caucasian actors.
Right.
And that to do both would require some difficult change. But, you know, through that process, we did have several actors who maintained, Tony being one of them, you know, Judith Marks, Tony's partner. So there was still a sense of community at Berkeley Rep.
Right.
And loosely affiliated company that then became other terrific art. Philip was in the Bay Area, Anna DeVere Smith was in the Bay Area at that time.
Right.
You know, and it was people had homes at Berkeley Rep without the same kind of company that Michael Liebert, my predecessor, had.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the beginning of the sort of what I would consider company more as an extended family. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. and I mean, because a similar thing was happening at Arena Stage mm-hmm. at the same time, where there was still a sort of nuclear company right. that could count on a certain amount of regular work. But that also, for a lot of those actors, they were expanding their careers to include more film and television work, right. and they weren't necessarily interested in 40 weeks of right. solid regional theater stage over yeah. and over and over again. And if you wanted to get some of them to do a show, you were going to get them for one show or maybe two in a right. year, not four or six.
Right. So. And it was also at the time, that was when Bill Ball, you know, sadly, he was still alive my first 2 years.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, but I never got to meet him.
Did you not?
No. Huh. Because he was pretty ill.
Yeah.
And so that company, which had also been very resident, very tight,
very.
Was also, so actors were working, you know, for the first time would work at ACT.
Crossing the bay.
As well as, you know, Joe Spano was a Berkeley Rep company member going down, and he was the star of Hill Street Blues.
Right.
You know, and then Tony now has a very active Hollywood career, Amendola. So it was true that it was kind of a sense of communion, but not yeah. necessarily as tightly knit company.
So when in all of this creative foment, which includes a lot of European-focused, devised work, ensemble work, and as mm-hmm. you said, Japanese theater and Asian-American theater, when did you first direct a so-called classic?
Early work was all from basically what we now call devised theater.
Yeah.
What we didn't call it that then, but yeah. it also mostly had a physical basis, poetic and very visual basis. So
yeah.
I was thought of for a long time as a visual director, as were you.
Yes, indeed.
And I married a playwright in Milwaukee. So...
Aha!
Aha!
Another occupational hazard.
I married a playwright, and through Amlin, and probably also through John, who I remember clearly saying, you know, you've got to, like, deal with words.
Right.
Right. And then marrying a playwright and directing his work.
Right.
Starting to understand language and understand that I actually had a gift for it.
Yeah.
Which I just had discounted. I really hadn't been thinking about it. And then...
Was that in part because you didn't really study that and you sort of thought, oh, I have to... Because I think sometimes, particularly with the classics, there's a sense of like, I'll hear this from directors old and young, oh, I didn't really study Shakespeare. And I'm like, I didn't really study Shakespeare either. I just got stuck doing a bunch of it, so...
Yeah, you know. I think with me it was like, I didn't study anything.
Right, right.
My mother, you know, my mom went to Mount Holyoke and... She was determined I would get into Wellesley or Mount Holyoke. So we
right.
did that whole tour. And
right.
A, you know, my SATs were so horrible in math that I wasn't going to get into those schools. But I also went to Bennington.
Yeah.
And Bennington, my first semester there, they basically disbanded and we studied Revolution and went down to D.C.
Oh, my
and,
God.
You know, that. Well, I still remember. I thought that was the best education possible.
Ever. Yeah.
And
yeah.
now wonder, why can't we do that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I was a very, very... anti-academic person in
yes.
my first, I didn't even want to go to college, you know, I wanted to just go do it.
Yes.
So Bennington was a last ditch attempt
yeah.
for my mom to get me into a college.
Right.
And then I actually didn't major in theater. I had a classic triple major, which you can't do anymore, but theater, music, and anthropology.
Wow.
And I first started as an anthropologist and then bolted that once I got accepted. Or was thinking, I can't even remember whether I was accepted or whether I was given strong indication that I would be accepted into Princeton. And I've just realized I don't want to be an academic.
Right.
At that point.
Right.
So that was around when I was 26 or 27.
Right.
So I had just, I guess that's, you know, part of my sense about playwrights like Shaw and Shakespeare was that you had to be an academic.
Right.
Or have those chops.
Right.
But... I did, I think the first real classic, and it's an oddball one, it's like The Way In, was the Revengers tragedy.
Nice.
That I did for John, you know, and I convinced him. I did a little workshop of it, because he was like, what?
The? Yeah.
And then we did it. Amlin adapted it slightly, called The Revenger, And we did it in Berkeley, in Milwaukee, and then it was one of the first things that I did at Berkeley as well. And that kind of got my feet wet through the back door of that very, you know, extreme visual. It was very visual,
very visual
production. But
yeah.
I did have to deal with the text and
right.
the history of it. And then I thought, okay, I will try Shakespeare. I'd been offered, it's the first and only time I've been offered anything at Ashland. Jerry Turner offered me Cymbeline. And I just went, it was my first, you know, Shakespeare, and I read it, and I went, no, I
no.
turned him down,
no.
and I've
yeah.
never been offered anything else at Ashland. And then I was very close friends with two fabulous designers. I still am, but one was Susan Hilferty.
Great.
And the other was Kate Edmonds. So I don't know whether it was their suggestion first or whether I just had a vision for how I could see Twelfth Night.
Mm-hmm.
So I did direct Twelfth Night at Berkeley Rep, and it was, if I do say so, it was really a beautiful version of Twelfth Night, and very successful. It extended, and it made me feel comfortable. It made me
right.
understand that, okay, I think I have a gift for this, because in some ways the epic structure that Shakespeare has suited in, I don't know, my devised theater background or something,
yes. yeah.
that the storytelling mode of moving from place to place and through all these plot lines didn't seem as intimidating as I had thought. And that because I, you know, triple majored, music was always an interest of mine, the musicality of the language came naturally to me.
Yeah.
And so that led to just more and more directing, feeling comfortable directing Shakespeare, and then, you know, ultimately, you know, I very late in life backed into academia, which I had always shunned, and realized that I could teach Shakespeare.
Right.
You know, so finally, getting prepared to teach young actors what I had only intuitively been doing, I read all the literature and sort of self-schooled
right.
on what everybody who was coming from a scholarly background had to say. So now I feel I've actually got, finally, you know, approaching 70, that I have the academic, mostly self-taught, but strongly taught, understanding, as well as just an intuitive grasp of how these plays work.
Well, that, I mean, being an autodidact seems to be a hallmark of your of your career, really,
yeah,
is
yeah.
that you keep putting yourself in situations where you have to learn,
have
and
to learn.
Then you do.
Yeah, it's true.
But I wonder if that's also just generally true of directors. Is it quite often a director is someone who will put themselves in a situation where they need to learn something new in order to pursue or follow the vision that they have, and you know, sometimes that's learning a musical vocabulary in order to be able to communicate with,
mm-hmm.
with a collaborator or
mm-hmm.
a visual one. Who designed that Twelfth Night? Was it Susan or Kate?
Susan, both.
Susan did? Oh,
yeah.
great.
And Dan Kotlowitz did the lights, and he's at Dartmouth now. And we,
yeah.
you know, Susan, and we did this kind of Picasso Blue Period version of it.
Nice.
That was,
nice.
And
brings
Eric,
out a little
Eric,
of the melancholy.
Eric, very much
it.
So.
Yeah.
And to me, I've done all the major comedies now, and they've all gone very well, and I think it is because I understand the melancholic base of all of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was another, I mean, you're talking about how we learn as directors. I had another, I do think we learn, those of us who pursue it as a career also learn from the masters, right, from watching
yeah.
the people. And another real influence on me was Garland Wright.
Yes.
As well as probably you.
Yes, me too. I was the assistant on Garland's last production of The Tempest.
Wow.
So I got to be in the room with him, and it stood me in incredible stead for my whole life and career. Actually.
Yeah,
so.
I never got to, you know, produce Garland or work with him, but a production of his of The Misanthrope that I saw at Seattle Rep
yeah.
when I was freelancing.
His Molière was
Molière, it was so
yeah.
stunning, and I remember distinctly years later with actually a production of Shaw of Heartbreak House at Berkeley, where I said to myself, okay, I think I'm as good as Garland.
Nice.
You know, where
nice.
It took me years to understand why his Misanthrope was so stunning.
And what do you think contributes to that?
Well, I mean, because in the final analysis, I still remember things visually.
Right.
Because he had a stunning design concept for it, as he did often.
Yeah.
But it was merged so beautifully with the text, the heartbreak of that relationship that should work and yet doesn't. And with the what he imagined, he said it. I just still remember it. Selimon, which was Kate Mulgrew,
in
a beautiful red dress with these red roses and a huge kind of hallway that had these mirrors. And at the very end, she's all alone with those roses, and rocks started to come through the windows started to break. So his sense of her world going to crumble in this bloody revolution, which is how he set the play. It was just fabulous. Yeah. And you know, it was just often with his work, one could sense a merging of a highly visual sense with a deep understanding of what the text was doing.
Yeah, his combination of his sort of painterly skill and his linguistic skill, and then really really smartly putting plays like that at the sort of crux of a moment of massive social change, so that what I always remember is that Garland would start telling the story as you entered the theater, somehow, whether he was doing anything or not, and he would never stop until you left. And it was like someone who was in charge. And that's one of the things I took away from him was, it's your responsibility as a director to take care of the audience from the time they set foot in the theater until the time they leave.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm curious about just because we talked about it, about how an anti-academic becomes a noted teacher and then the chair of multiple different theater training programs. So
a little case in point, I was not the chair at Savannah College.
Oh, good
of
point.
Art
okay, thank you. Yes, so you were the head of the theater.
I was the artistic director.
Artistic director.
And I worked in collaboration with my wonderful colleague, Michael Weinstein.
Okay, good.
Who
thanks
was the
that.
Actual chair.
Okay.
So VCU is the first time I've been a chair.
Okay, good. So you're continuing to advance in your academic
career. I suppose one could call that.
Yeah.
Although being a chair, one never knows if that's advancing or
is
not.
Is it like artistic directing?
No.
No.
It's harder.
It's harder.
Yeah. Because you have more constituents, you know, and also you don't have control.
Right.
I mean, artistic directing, you share control with a managing director, but ultimately the decisions are yours, and the shared governance of a university makes it so that the decisions can't solely be yours, and that's beautiful in some ways and really hard in others.
Right, particularly when it comes to art.
Particularly when it comes to art and aesthetics and trying to, have a vision.
So as someone who is visual, and we've talked about your own background in that and then appreciation for the work of Garland, and certainly that's been part of my background too, I'm curious what you found the challenges to be of coming to a place like the American Shakespeare Center, where in the Blackfriars we embrace what we call Shakespearean performance conditions, which means basically shared universal lighting, so no light cues, no recorded sound, so everything is performed and made by the company of actors, a consciously limited company of no more than 16, in our case, supposed to be 14, but both you and I expanded our,
I think we
learned something about what a director is, which is like, you tell them 14 and they end up with 16, but, a more or less set, scenic space, which is the theater itself with a francesca and a kind of, three-quarter thrust Shakespearean stage. But what is it like to take away those things, and where does that energy go in terms of the focus of the director?
Well, I mean, first of all, if I had come here before working for Utah a couple times, I think it would have been more of a shock than it was, because the big shock is just getting into any space that resembles architecturally his, where you suddenly go, oh, that makes it easier, and that makes the storytelling better and swifter and all those things. So I'd already learned that lesson from being at Utah Shakes twice in the old Adams Theater.
Right. Beautiful space.
Beautiful space. And just about how swiftly you can go from one. But so the new things are no lights.
Yeah.
No lighting cues. And the true company, which not only is music, but also who's moving a curtain and who's moving this prop and all of that.
Right.
Which Chris Johnston, your wonderful company manager.
Actor manager for music.
Said it's a palate cleanser, right? And I thought it really is. It's like a bracing jump in a cold mountain lake, you know, where you go, okay, that's what it is. And the focus really truly does go to the detail work between the actors.
Yeah.
And as you and I both are, you're fiddling with staging, in fact, a lot more. Because it's the whole picture, right? The arrangement of the people, their relationship to the audience, the space. It makes it, what you do always becomes even more intense because that's it.
Well, I found there's no other tool for giving and sharing focus because normally we might use a light cue to help guide the focus or reinforce a focus choice. Mm-hmm. Or we might use a sound cue to help fill in an emotional space. And I think you've done a beautiful job of creating underscoring throughout the Antony and Cleopatra out live and out of this very organic sense, which is really amazing and sort of visceral when you feel it. But yeah, that part is definitely a challenge.
But you see, I mean, again, a production that I just adored was Mark Rylance's Twelfth Night.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do see people who have done just fabulous, you know, versions of Shakespeare in conditions that resemble yours here, it's great. You know, I love it. I love it. And have really found that it's, you know, in many ways, I wish I were teaching a graduate directing class. And I had some young directors. We have Dan, but other young students with us to watch how one grapples with these questions. And
well, and having I think, again, having grown up in the very visual theater of the 70s and 80s, and that was my background as an audience member and then as an early director, And all of that, there is something something about that being a reflex for how we tell stories, and it does take some time to go, okay, well, without that, I'm still a storyteller. So how am I going to tell this story effectively? How am I going to communicate? And there is the terrible realization that every time you sit down to start designing a set in a traditional proscenium theater for a Shakespeare play, you do just end up putting stuff in the way.
It's true. It's true. And I haven't directed a Shakespeare since I'm trying to think. I don't think I have. No, I directed The Tempest at Georgia Shakespeare, which was an indoor. But I have been working, you know, a lot in Boise Shakespeare, which is outdoor.
See, you did some of the great state Shakespeare festivals, Idaho, Utah.
Right. So. It's interesting, you know, Idaho's interesting because they also produce in Cleveland.
As so Great that, Lakes, right.
Great so Lakes, yes. So that, doing much ado in that situation, was a learning experience.
Are both of those venues outdoors?
No, the Cleveland one is indoors and the Boise one is outdoors. So that is actually really interesting to see, and I, you know, would like to go back and try it again. This one, Much Ado, was started in Cleveland and then went outdoors, and I'd actually like to go the other way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I did get caught in the it was a beautiful indoor production, and then it moved to Boise, where it doesn't even get dark till 10 at night.
Right, of course. And suddenly, you're in the summertime in the northern part of the.
We're right there.
Right.
So that was a very interesting learning experience.
What were the shows you did in Utah? Was a
Merchant of Venice and King Lear, both with Berkeley rep with Tony Amendola.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
And what about, so what was the journey from Berkeley rep to Seattle rep? And how did you make that? Did you make that leap from one to the next? Was it fairly direct, right?
Yeah. It was. You know, I mean, I had been at Berkeley 13 years.
Yeah.
And I have to admit to being, you know, in a position where I knew Berkeley Rep had to, we were just in the thrust stage.
Right.
And Susie Medic and I.
That beautiful asymmetrical.
Beautiful, still one of my favorite spaces in the world.
Yeah.
I had two great managing director partners at Berkeley, Mitzi Sales and Susie Medic, who is still there.
Yeah, you know Susie well.
And Susie, we knew that the theater had to have another space besides that thrust stage, and we just kept hitting various brick walls. And also, I kind of knew that the original intent that I had come to do, which was to really build the company to a national reputation and bust open the programming to become more, and the company, to become more diverse, like the area that it lived in, that I had done all that. So I knew intuitively that it was going to have to, I was going to have to change and take it a different direction if I were to stay. And kind of at that point, Seattle Rep kind of, you know, and I'm going to say something here that may seem mean, but it isn't meant that way. But this was before the age of big search firms.
Yeah.
Where theaters, you know, Berkeley found me. Berkeley found me with no help. Seattle Rep found me with no help.
Right.
And, you know, they kind of came a-knockin', and I thought, okay, I always loved Seattle. I had freelance directed there and loved the city, and thought that I saw something I could do for that theater company,
right.
Which was, you know, Dan had built it tremendously, sort of the same build that
I
had.
In parallel, I mean, this was a time where I feel like we had this great sense of the Pacific Northwest and Northern California becoming these incredible American theater centers for us.
And my son was still young, he was 4, so it was sort of like, if you're going to make a move,
do it before he gets too far into school.
I mean, the poor kid, I moved him to Savannah, Georgia from Seattle when he was in middle school, which was, that was pretty tough. But it felt like a good time, and it felt like I was able to do something that not many people do, which is kind of leave at the height of something. And I was just worried. I was worried that I was going to feel more and more frustrated if there wasn't a second space, and that it was going to be, you know, a period of decline.
Yeah.
And of course, the minute I left, everything broke open, and they got the second space, and Tony was able to. Tony Taccone was my associate artistic director. So, and now he's leaving, and I have to.
Yes.
I have to be proud of Berkeley Rep for the. He stayed 20 years.
20 years.
And Susie, so almost continual. Many of the people who, you know, worked with me stayed all through Tony. Almost 33 years of a kind of. Not, I mean, Tony does a lot different programming than I did, and the theater now does much more New York work than I did when I was there. But it's been kind of a cohesive whole for a long, long time.
Yeah, you really sense that.
But that was the move. Just that felt like the right time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought, and without any disrespect to anyone who has stayed longer, that one of the observations I've had is that a great big difference between theater in, say, the UK and the United States is that in the UK, if you become an artistic director, you don't plan to stay for more than about 8 or 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the length of a term, even maybe a 2 terms.
Mm-hmm.
And that the role isn't regarded as a kind of
life situation.
Life appointment or a tenured appointment, so much as I'm going to come. And for me personally, even though I'm only in the beginning of my time here at the American Shakespeare Center, and I'd love to stay forever, on the other hand, I feel like a decade, a dozen years of stories, those might be the stories I have to tell
in this space
to this audience, and then it would be a good time to move on and find another place to go. And that energy of both the wanting to have a home base and to remain always able to move on. And I'm thinking back to the quote in the Yale brochure saying, you know, we don't want to foster peripatetic artists. Right. And then I think, is that inherent to being a director? Is that a certain time it's good to move on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it's both. I mean, people ask me now, where am I from? And I actually don't have.
Where are you from? Where were you born?
Western Pennsylvania.
Okay. Near Pittsburgh or?
No, in the very northern reaches of Appalachia. So between Pittsburgh and Erie.
Oh, wow.
Total Trump country.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, near where
I know well from my time in Chautauqua in Western New York.
Well,
out there,
that was.
So.
Chautauqua was 30 miles north. So
great.
I'm from Corry, which is 30 miles away from Chautauqua.
That is pretty rural.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah.
Yep.
So anyway, people ask you where you're from now, and
I don't. Well, when we left Seattle and moved to Savannah, that's when we just went, okay.
Yeah.
We do not, and we lived in Savannah for 10 years. Wow. So, you know, we lived there as long as we lived in Seattle. So, you know.
Which I also then think this, your ability to go to sort of antipodal sides of the United States of America. I mean, two wonderful, cultural, creative, gorgeous different cities and communities, but Seattle is in one corner and Savannah is practically in the other corner
totally.
Of the country.
Totally. They really are.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're like,
what was the experience of going from the Pacific Northwest to the deep American South?
Really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And surprising in the most, you know, I mean, every new place surprises you, right? But the living in Savannah surprised me the most because of, you know, I mean, I was from rural Pennsylvania, but my parents went to Chautauqua every summer.
Right.
And, you know, so I was culturally exposed, even though I would not have been if my mom hadn't taken us to Chautauqua and gone to the theater.
Sure.
Her name's on the little theater.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, but living in Savannah and really understanding or feeling like I started to understand American history from a different point of view, what has been really great. I don't quite know how I'm processing all that, but I know that my life and my sense of the world would be very different if I had stayed in either Berkeley or Seattle.
Yeah.
Very different. And I purposefully was interested in exposing our son. You know, I was purposely very interested in having our son grow up not necessarily always in the liberal bastions of the Bay Area or Seattle.
Sure.
And he certainly did not.
Right.
He wound up going to a Benedictine military school in Savannah, whose most famous alum is Justice Clarence Thomas.
Wow.
So he really was thrown into the deep end.
Yeah.
And he's an adopted Hispanic young man.
Yeah.
So he was really thrown in to a very, very different world that he understood and B kind of thrived in.
Yeah.
You know, so it was very interesting.
Has it, and thinking about both the geography, but also directing and teaching emerging younger artists, does that change what you want to direct? Or how you evaluate a...
Certainly changes how I evaluate. I mean, you and I talked about To Kill a Mockingbird. And,
right.
You know, I have a different perspective on literature now that, and anything that, I read Timothy Egan's, if you read his article today in the New York Times.
I haven't had a chance to read the paper today.
Well, it's an interesting, and he does take a swipe at the American South. I mean, he's a Seattle-based writer.
Uh-huh.
And I love his writing, but my first instinct was to fact-check him on everything. And actually, it fact-checks out, and it's pretty scary. But he, you know, paints the South as, you know, full of Confederates.
Yeah.
You know, and I now... I have a much different picture of the South. That exists, but there's also the new South of Atlanta, and Richmond, which is a very different kind. It doesn't, and here, well, Stanton, and it doesn't fit the mold of what people think of as the South at all.
Sort of Virginia and the Carolinas.
And the people.
And a cultural, I mean, a real cultural renaissance going on regionally, and just a lot of energy around that. Mm-hmm. Charlottesville. I mean, you think about all that, and I agree, it's very easy. I mean, I grew up in Washington, D.C., which is hardly northern.
Right.
I think, what do they say about it? It has northern charm and southern efficiency is what they say about Washington, D.C. But without recognizing that there is a big change underway. And yeah, if you look at the cultural flowering of Atlanta, is also really
meaningful. And you look at, you know, just even the people, Stacey Abrams and the people who are emerging, I really think that leadership for a new America is likely to come from the South in some way.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, I don't, it doesn't necessarily change what I want to direct, but it makes me wish I could write.
Nice.
Which I don't think I can, but I keep looking at...
Except that, Sharon, I feel like I don't think I can has been the beginning of you doing something extraordinary every time.
Well,
so
that
perhaps,
would be great.
Perhaps we've got, right now, we've canned the moment where you go, I don't think I can, and now 2 years from now we'll be on your book tour and we'll do a follow-up. And
you know, but when I saw Jez Butter, when I saw The Ferryman, you know, I did wish that there were American writers, preferably from the South, who could write something about our troubled history of violence with as much depth and as little didactic politicking as he was able to do with Irish history. And I haven't yet, you know, found that or found the writing or found even for myself, like, what would be the kernel of that story?
Yeah.
Where would you do it? How would you start?
Yeah. Well, it does strike me, though, that, again, there's a reflex among writers in the UK to write for the theater and to write for the stage. And we have those writers, but they're not always writing for the theater.
That's true.
And you know, it's not something, if you're not used to writing for the theater, it's not something you can sort of suddenly
do.
Pick up and do, because it is a different method of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was another thing I just wanted to talk to you about, because here at American Shakespeare Center, we have a new program called the Shakespeare's New Contemporaries, which is a commissioning competition to identify a play or written in conversation with a Shakespeare antecedent. So it's not a translation or an adaptation of a Shakespeare play, but a play written in reference to it. So this year we produced a play called Anne Page Hates Fun in relation to Merry Wives of Windsor, and it was set in contemporary Windsor, New Hampshire, and followed a character who is given distinctly little to say in Shakespeare's play. And then a play called 16 Winters in relation to the Winter's Tale. But you've, with Amy Freed, you've done a bunch of stuff that all of which to me would qualify entirely under this sort of Shakespeare's New Contemporaries idea that ASC is trying to pioneer. What was the origin of that? Or, I mean, because I, you, Restoration, well, I'm thinking of Restoration Comedy.
Restoration Comedy. Well, I, you know, Amy and I,
You Nero.
Oh,
I love
that
play.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah.
It's sort of, now's the time for that
play. Oh my gosh, yes, right?
We were
Let's
just a little bit ahead of the time with
yes,
that
it's
one.
Yes, true. It's
but
true.
But man, I'm just
We thought
continuing.
It was a history and it wasn't.
It wasn't. It was present. So Amy was, she's a little bit younger than I am, so she was just sort of coming up through ACT as an actor as I was leaving the Bay Area. So I got to know her through the Beard of Avon, which South Coast premiered.
Yes.
And Kurt Beatty, who was for many years the artistic director at ACT, was Dan's literary manager, Sullivan, and then also mine. And he was the first person who said, oh, you know, Amy from, you know, this play is really good at South Coast, but it might need another. So Amy did her second production of Beard of Avon at Seattle Rep that I directed.
I see.
And it was, you know, we dropped two of the final scenes. It was fairly radically compressed and rewritten, and that became the production that went to New York Theater Workshop, and
right.
is still the one, not that, my production, but that version of
that
the
version.
Play.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so we developed a bond, and then, you know, she had this kooky idea of these two relatively, the relapse John Vanbrugh's play that is produced every once in a while, and Colley Sibber's play, Love's Last Shift, that's never produced, that they could be combined into one play. And Carrie Perloff was the first person who said, come work with the ACT students. And, you know, so we did a development thing
idea.
Of two, yeah. I think 2 weeks, where we just mashed the plays together.
Right.
Just to see what we could do. And then we did a workshop at Seattle Rep and then one at South Coast Rep and then premiered it. And that was just great fun, you know. And Amy's such a wonderful, she's one of our most gifted verbal writers, you know. And I just love her work. And I have a good sense of humor. And I just love what she does with language and how she attacks these older plays,
yeah.
you know. So,
yeah.
So, and then You Nero premiered, it was a joint premiere with South Coast and Berkeley Rep. And then, of course, her Shrew.
Yes.
Which I think you would do well to do here. But it is an adaptation of Shakespeare's play, but it's speaking about, I mean, to me, it is in conversation.
And that
in
Shrew,
deep conversation.
Yeah, it is. Because it was written initially as part of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival commissions. Because didn't Amy take one of those?
She did take one of
but
those.
But then she went so far beyond the brief that it became its own. This
yeah,
one
she,
became its own
play.
And
she actually was, you know, we were in contact. She was saying, she did the Oregon Shakespeare, what they
right.
asked her to do. But she said, as I was doing that, I realized I have another,
right.
you know, I'm not done with this.
Right.
So she did, and it's really a similar thing to me with what she did with, I mean, Colley Sibber's play, she took some bones from it, but Vanbrugh's play, The Relapse, is the more solid of the two. And she basically wrote the woman, the main woman,
yeah.
that neither of those two men could really visual. Really,
yeah, they couldn't imagine.
They couldn't imagine. No. And I think with Shakespeare's play, A, she makes the funny guys funnier.
Yeah.
And B, because that's always hard with Shrew. You're going, is that really funny? And B, she takes the relationship of Kate and Petruchio seriously
yeah.
and rethinks it from a contemporary context. So it is in deep conversation. And of course, the play, people have trouble. It's not being produced as much as I wish it would.
Yeah.
Because I think people think, well, why isn't it a more radical feminist version?
Right.
Or why isn't it something else? It really is a response to Shakespeare's play seen through this very gifted, you know, 21st century American woman's eyes.
Yeah.
So I love it. You know
what
I love her.
I love about that is that also, though, in first off, here you originally say, well, I started out not thinking I really knew a lot about the classics, and then you just casually drop references to Colley Sibber and and The Relapse, and then you describe a process for creating that work that seems very much to draw on your entire history of devising and mashing up and creating work that goes all the way back to your days at Theater X and in the ensemble of the, what was the group that toured Europe?
Theater X.
So yeah.
The group was Camera Obscura, the one that was in residence at the Mickery. Theater.
So I see all of that as sort of, as in some way, a kind of evolutionary ongoing sort of the continuity of your artistic self sort of speaking to itself over and over and over again. Where you're going to open Antony and Cleopatra tomorrow here. It's a beautiful production. I couldn't be more proud for it to be part of my first summer. I'm so delighted that you were just courageous in accepting the invitation to come into a situation that, you know, neither of us knew exactly what we were getting ourselves into. But now I see that also that too is a hallmark of your life's work, is just agreeing to get yourself into situations without knowing how they will turn out. This one has turned out really, really well. But any thoughts on Antony and Cleopatra now that you're about to sort of release it into a nice long run here that will be on stage from now. It's just the day after July 4th until Thanksgiving, sometime mm-hmm. after Thanksgiving, but
mm-hmm. maybe two. You know, that it is a play. It's not as hard as Cymbeline.
but maybe close.
Yeah. And it is one where I really, you know, some of the play, like Twelfth Night, when you do Twelfth Night or you do Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, or King Lear, you kind of know from the beginning that you're dealing with this. King Lear, maybe not quite as perfect as the other two, but mm-hmm. this work of art that you go, okay, there's that beautiful work of art, and there's humble little me, and I'm going to... Antony and Cleopatra is a bit of a mess.
Yeah.
But I have just come to love the play in a way that, I mean, it's a little similar to the way I fell in love with George Bernard Shaw's Heartbreak House.
Yeah.
You know, just, it's a huge sprawling thing, but the ambition and the just the soul behind it and the pure, in both those cases, Shaw's play, and the sheer understanding of beauty, of language, and of depth of human feeling is just not to be surpassed. So you just have to kind of get through in Antony and Cleopatra. Okay, we got battle X, battle Y, battle Z, and understand that what he's really after with these two extraordinary human beings who were actual human beings is just amazing. And also, your company, I mean, we all, this sort of harkens back to my ensemble beginnings. We all try to create a sense of ensemble when we direct, but the circumstances of producing here create a sense of ensemble that is truly wondrous. You know, some of it is just the music that they all do, where you go, my God, they all have to play instruments and do this music together. But it's also just, I'll pull that curtain and I'll, you know, there are only two people backstage.
Right.
And so it's the company really pitching in, and that sense of ensemble that I haven't felt for a long, long time, you know, that is really a joy.
Well, it's a great reminder that that is also something to be treasured.
Absolutely.
And
kept.
And kept and mm-hmm. nurtured.
And nurtured, yep.
As best as we can. Well, Sharon, thank you so very much for this incredible conversation.
Thanks,
and for
Ethan.
Sharing some of these beautiful stories and insights from your career, peripatetic as it has been. And it's just a great joy to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, awesome.